Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, Canada, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black Rock, Little Rock, Oskaloosa, Tennessee, Tennessee, Chicopee, Spirit Lake, Grand Lake, Devil's Lake, Crater Lake, the Beach Lake. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Louisville, Nashville, Knoxville, Ombabaka, Shepherdville, Jacksonville, Waterville, Coastal Rica, Pittsfield, Springfield, Bakersfield, Shreveport, Hackensack, Cadillac, Fond du Lac, Davenport, Idaho, Jellicoe, Argentina, Diamantina, Pasadena, Catalina, Sea, Guatemala. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Pittsburgh, Parkersburg, Gravelburg, Colorado, Ellensburg, Rexburg, Vicksburg, Eldorado, Larimore, Atmore, Havistraw, Chattanooga, Chaska, Nebraska, Alaska, Opelika, Baraboo, Waterloo, Kalamazoo, Kansas City, Sioux City, Cedar City, Dodge City, Water City. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been everywhere.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. All right, folks over there in the control panel, what happened? In the first time in the history of our show, more than a year, we got cut off and the whole system froze up and we couldn't use the switchboard and we got dropped off the show, and when we came back on, it wouldn't log on, so there must have been server problems or something, but we're back. And unfortunately, tonight we had a very crowded agenda, but we'll have to shorten that a little bit. But welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Blog Talk Radio. If you've never heard the show and you stuck around 15 minutes for us to get started, I certainly apologize for that. Johnny Cash, we want to thank you for singing that song. I think that came through, and I thought I could hear sleigh bells in the background of that trip you make across 90 cities and states in the United States. And Emily, Mike, thanks again for being here tonight and particularly helping us get back up on the air. I think what we're going to do, ladies and gentlemen, sort of shorten some of the introduction. If you listen regularly, you know by now that our show is dedicated to those tireless professionals in the field of criminal justice, police courts, corrections, and the juvenile justice field who serve us throughout the world. What we try to do in the show is look inside criminal justice practice and take a good look at criminal justice professionals. And tonight we have a very special show lined up, and we had some rather long segments, but what we're trying to do in this show is to take a look at the problem again. We've done this once with Professor Michael Lewis. Well, we're going to take a look again at the problem of the homeless and the police and their responsibilities and society. And sometimes we find circumstances where the police have tried to work on this problem before, or other agencies have tried to work, and the two different sides, if you could call it that, don't necessarily get along. It's not that the final goal, eliminating the homeless and providing safe and secure in humane places for folks to live who are homeless, but sometimes the path to get there, the means to do that, is seen differently. So tonight we're going to take a look at comments by Heather McDonald, who's a very fine writer. Those of you familiar with City Journal or city-journal.org on the Internet, that is the host for and the repository for literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of articles, generally written from the conservative perspective, but Heather McDonald is one of the best writers. And she's going to take a look at what's going on in Skid Row in Los Angeles. And she's very laudatory of the Los Angeles police and what they're doing, but they're doing this without opposition. They've actually lowered crime rates. They've gotten some of the homeless people off the streets. They're trying to make the streets clean. In fact, you'll hear them talk about the cops in one of these segments riding with the steam cleaners, and yet the police are resisted in some of these efforts. So it's a very interesting story and a problem that we're plagued with. In the second segment, we're going to listen to a couple people that are working with the homeless. One of those is from the city of Dallas, and Professor Michael Lewis talked about that when we had him on the show several months ago. He actually visited Dallas when they were taking a homeless census. So I think what we're going to do, we're going to skip the news. We had some very interesting stories about America's toughest sheriff again out there in Maricopa County, and then a little news about the 13-year low in terms of executions in the United States. But yes, Texas still is maintaining number one, but we're going to come in this year with substantially fewer than we've had since 1994, so it's interesting why that's going on. But let's go ahead and get started with the segment about with Heather McDonald concerning what's going on in Skid Row. And I think you'll find this very, very interesting.
This is Brian Anderson, the editor of City Journal, and I'm here with Heather McDonald, City Journal contributing editor, John M. Olin Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and author of Are Cops Racist? And co-author of the forthcoming The Immigration Solution. Heather has written a fascinating piece for the autumn 2007 City Journal entitled The Reclamation of Skid Row, which reports on a gripping battle to take back America's most squalid stretch of urban turf, a 50-square block of L.A. dominated by mentally ill vagrants, drug dealers, and other antisocial types. Heather, what's happening on Skid Row, and why write a story about it now?
Brian, there's a transformation of Skid Row that people have been hoping would happen for the last 25 years, and they never thought it would, because the advocates of anarchy have controlled that area. They have brought Skid Row to a level of despair and degradation that no one who has not seen it can possibly imagine. But finally, the police have effected a miracle there through sound, compassionate policing. They have brought order back, and the advocates are fighting back hard. Even though people who've been most helped by the policing effort on Skid Row are the law-abiding homeless and addicts that are finally able to get help without having the drug trade swirling around them, the advocates are determined to stop the police and bring it back to the previous state of anarchy. So this is, I think it's a story about the power of policing to change lives for the better, to change cities for the better, but the forces of chaos that they have to battle to get there.
Now, are these advocates opposing these new policing initiatives on legal grounds, or is it just a public campaign to shame the police? What exactly is happening on the ground, and if you could describe that a little bit?
The advocates fight on every possible terrain they can find. They have fought through the courts, every single policing effort over the last 25 years to try and enforce the law in Skid Row. They believe that Skid Row should be a law-free zone. So they've been dragging the police in the city into court for years, drawing enormous resources away from public safety. They can always call on the elite law firms of downtown Los Angeles, who will provide pro bono work for them for free. These are lawyers that are paid $500 an hour, up against city attorneys that are barely getting by, that don't have the resources. At the same time, though, they have mobilized protests in the streets. For instance, in 2006, the Business Improvement District on Skid Row decided that the filth and disease that was taking over the sidewalks through these encampments was to such a degree of danger that they needed to do steam cleaning of the sidewalks and bring in professional steam cleaners. The advocates responded to this by having civil disobedience lie down protests underneath the sanitation trucks to prevent the cleaning.
But what could they possibly be objecting to in street cleaning?
They're certainly not objecting to hurting the homeless, because the bid had specifically said all we're asking the street vagrants to do is temporarily move their belongings for the 2 hours during the street cleaning and come back as soon as we've cleaned the streets for them. So they tried to portray this as an anti-homeless campaign, whereas in fact it was merely making cleaner streets for the homeless. They feel that any small step towards sanity is going to lead to bigger steps towards sanity. So they draw a line on the sand that says we need maximal filth, maximal ugliness, and we are going to stop what they call criminalization of the homeless. What they also objected to was that the police were accompanying the sanitation trucks, and one of the advocates said, aha, you see, this just shows that this is part of this so-called campaign to criminalize homelessness. Well, it is true that in other parts of the city, as she said, the police don't ordinarily accompany sanitation trucks, but that's because in other parts of the city, you don't have mentally ill crack addicts, psychopaths who attack sanitation workers and put them at risk of their lives. This is the sort of situation that the advocates want to preserve on Skid Row that the police have finally been able to turn around.
And what is the attitude of the mayor of L.A. in this struggle between advocates and the police?
Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa is in a very complicated situation because his roots are in the advocacy community. He was a president of the ACLU of Southern California. He moved up through the union ranks. That is his base. But he is now scandal-plagued. He was carrying on an affair with a Telemundo reporter who was covering the City Hall at the same time. And his other initiatives in Los Angeles have pretty much fallen apart. His effort to take control of the schools failed. So right now, his only accomplishment is policing. William Bratton, who came from New York City, has been applying the Comstat model of policing from New York to Los Angeles. He's bringing crime down. So Villaraigosa...
And crime has dropped in Skid Row dramatically, right?
It's the greatest crime drop in the entire city, thanks to this charismatic Captain Andrew Smith, who has turned things around there. So for the moment, Villaraigosa is backing the policing effort. Nevertheless, there is a renewed effort of the advocates now to stop the policing there, to stop the broken windows theory, and they have the attention of City Hall. So I actually don't know what the final conclusion of this story is going to be, Brian, because the advocates are fighting back hard. I think it's something that everybody should follow because it is a moral for urban America that even the most squalid conditions can be turned around, but you have to fight constantly.
Thanks very much, Heather. To read Heather McDonald's essay, The Reclamation of Skid Row, please visit our website, www.city-journal.org. Thanks, Heather.
Well, that's a very interesting essay that she's written also, and I'd encourage you to go to www.city-journal.org and read that full essay. She's a very talented writer and has a good set of eyes and is able to pick up on a lot of things in society, and I think you'll enjoy that one for sure. Now, the setup is kind of interesting out there in Los Angeles, isn't it? The police have the right heart about trying to do something about the homeless. You know, I don't know if you do realize, but L.A.'s under court order. They're not permitted to remove any of the homeless from these little small housing units, tents, if you will, that they build in front of businesses and residences right on the streets in Skid Row in Los Angeles, and they can't move them. And the court has said something like they have to build 7,300, don't quote me on the exact figure, but they have to build new resident housing facilities for the homeless before they're permitted to move any of these people away. And I don't talk about people's research that I haven't gotten permission to talk about first, but I know of a person who's actually just conducted a research project out there who happens to be a police officer, and what she did was go out and interview people who own these businesses where the homeless are encamped right in the sidewalk in front of their business establishment. And boy, was it a very interesting experience. And, you know, you can go right there, and sometimes I guess the smell will just overwhelm you because of the defecation, the urine, and that's really what the police were trying to clean up in terms of this one particular steam cleaning operation. But it's going to be interesting to see what happens. But again, tributes paid to Chief William Bratton, who you can read about what he did in New York in his book, Turnaround. And he was there with, of course, Mayor Giuliani at the time, or for most of the time. And Bratton also did the same thing with the New York City transit system. Dropped crime substantially, cleaned it up, stopped the turnstile jumping, on and on and on. So he has a record of doing something, and it looks like he's been substantially dropping crime in Los Angeles. And in my humble opinion, I would say that that's probably the toughest city in the United States to do that in. There are just so many dynamics there that make it difficult, and illegal immigration being one of them, the warm weather, just a lot of reasons why people would gravitate to Los Angeles and stay there. if they were homeless. So very interesting. I think what we'll do next is go ahead and start this other segment because the two fit together very well. And this provides a little broader context for what we're doing with the homeless in some of the large cities in the United States. And we're not going to be able to use our switchboard for this one. We have to go back to some 2006 Blog Talk Radio technique. So bear with me just a moment, and I believe this will work.
Talk to the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Coney. Homelessness in America is a problem we stare in the face every day. Often we turn our heads trying to ignore it, or we pretend we don't see it at all. Sometimes we might give someone money, a dollar or two, maybe five, to feel as if we've done our part. But at the end of the day, they're still there, the homeless, and we haven't really done a thing. The most recent Census Bureau estimates say there are more than 740,000 homeless people in the United States. A study from the National Alliance to End Homelessness says there is 1 in 4 homeless people are military veterans. Many cities have undertaken ambitious plans to effectively end homelessness where they live. We'll be joined by one man who's volunteered to become the homeless czar of his city. And later in the hour, Hugo Chavez is shot to become president for life. Venezuela's ambassador to the U.S. joins us. But first, can we solve the problem of homelessness? If you've ever been homeless, give us a call. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining us now is Mike Rawlings, homeless czar of Dallas. He joins us from Cake Mix Reporting in Dallas. Mike, so good to have you on the program.
Thank you for being interested. It's good to be here.
Now, a lot of cities have come up with plans to end homelessness. The Dallas plan calls for ending homelessness within 10 years. Why do you think this is one that's going to work?
Well, I think, first of all, when you deal with a problem like homelessness, which has been around for decades and centuries in many ways, you have to take it apart, understand it, understand the situation, root cause, and you've got to have a big vision. And I think we've got a big vision, then you've got to have a plan that's tested and kind of proven. You've got to get the right resources, the right people and the money, and then you've got to execute and measure. And we've got all those components in place, so I think we've got a good chance of making it work. And we're well on our way. We've seen results already.
Now, the focal point, or at least one of the focal points of the Dallas plan for ending homelessness, is to do what you call a homeless assistance center. Why is that so important, and what is it?
Well, that's our first part of our four-part plan. In Dallas, and each plan across the nation, I think, is really customized to that situation and that place. In Dallas, we did not have a 24-hour facility to be able to co-locate all the services that the homeless need. The homeless need, besides just the basic hygiene, showers and restrooms and food, they need physical health needs. They've got mental health needs. They've got job training needs. They've got VA needs. And we didn't have a place like that. So we wanted to create a home for the homeless there in Dallas so they're able to come, get the resources they need, and when they are able to do that, then they're going to be able to more easily springboard into our next step, which you mentioned earlier, which is giving them housing, permanent supportive housing, and that's our next step for our plan.
How is your center? And I know you said it's not a shelter. You said it's a springboard to the next step, but I've read you said that you don't think of it as a shelter. How is it different from a traditional shelter?
Well, I think a traditional shelter is primary purpose is to get people in a bed and make sure that they're warm and they've got a place to sleep. We only are going to have 100 beds in our facility, We're going to have a sleeping area for more than that, but that's not the purpose of it. We spent a lot more money into counseling offices, into the places that they're able to get IDs, and get all the legal aid they need, those sort of services. So our focus is slightly different. We've got shelters in Dallas, and we've got a lot of people that are doing that, and there are some good programs. There are a lot of homeless people that are shelter-resistant, and that's why we're going to allow this to be a 24-hour, come-as-you-go, very few rules sort of place that they can feel comfortable to come and be at and get the services they need.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because a lot of homeless just won't go to shelters. And as you mentioned rules, they don't like the rules that are enforced. They don't like the fact that they spend the night there, they take care of the bed at a certain point, they can only come back at another point. But you're saying that you're not going to have rules? You're not going to have rules?
Well, you know, one of the, obviously, it's going to be a safe place. They're not going to be able to bring drugs and alcohol and weapons. They're going to be a place that people feel safe. But we want this to be their facility, not our facility done for them. It'll be a place that is very inviting. As I said, open 24 hours. We're not going to kind of close the doors like a lot of shelters do at a certain time of night and get everybody back on the streets at 6 o'clock in the morning. There won't be a program that people have to go through. That's one of the reasons some people don't like shelters. Some people work late and can't do that. And many shelters do come with a cost, a $10 a night program that they just don't have the cash to do that.
Let me make sure I understand this. So there will still be shelters in Dallas, and the shelters will operate as they always have traditionally, giving people a place to get out of the cold or
right,
for the night. Those will still be going on. So you're saying this, the emphasis on this will be more of a long-term therapy.
It will be more about being a springboard. People are going to come here to get the basic services they need, but then we're going to put an intensive case management program in. We're raising $20 million of private money to match the city and county money so we can make sure that they get the case management they need. I liken it to a restaurant. You know, you can go to a good restaurant and a waiter or a person might have only two or three tables, and you go to another place and there'll be six tables. Now, who's getting better service? We want to make sure that we have the people that are getting the service that treat these people as the individuals they should be, customize the programs that they have, and our goals are going to be able to get them out as quickly as we can into permanent housing.
We are talking with Mike Rawlings. He is the Metro Dallas Homeless, he chairs the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance, and we are asking the question, can we solve homelessness? We've got a call on the line from Brian, who's calling from Eugene, Oregon. Hi, Brian.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, my own mother is homeless, has been homeless on and off since I was a kid, mostly on. And I feel like, you know, I almost feel guilty, like I don't do enough to try to help her out, but I realize there's not a whole lot I can do. I mean, she's been in prison, she's been in rehab, she has mental health issues. That's really what she needs the most help with. But as a child, if someone is homeless, and, you know, I'm a college graduate, I have a good job, I'm married, I'm, you know, fairly successful. It's just, it's really hard to know what I can do, what I should do, and to not feel guilty. I don't know if you're the person you have on today could say anything about that.
Do you have any advice?
Well, you know, first of all, I think you got to do everything you can do. I mean, at least as I look at myself, my family members, you've got to reach out. At some point, you know that your work with that person is getting diminishing returns, and you've got to be realistic about that. So I'm not here to judge your actions or to opine on your situation. I do think your mother is not dissimilar than a lot of folks out there. That mental illness is such a root cause of this, and we in this country, and specifically in Texas, we're very bad at funding and putting programs in place for mental illness. And the most important thing is to see while there's a lot of personal choices your mother made and a lot of homeless people make, the root cause there is they're just not mentally right and they need the help there. So I think that's what we're doing. The third part of our plan in Dallas is create a better focus on mental health, make more accountability and best practices. I'm fascinated that our mental health system in the United States isn't as clear on the best practices and the productive nature of mental health as the physical side of this thing is. And we've got to make progress in that regard.
Thanks for your call, Brian. I wanted to ask you, Mr. Rawlings, you know, I've read also that Dallas has passed some laws aimed at dealing with homelessness, particularly the problem of panhandling, which critics say are really punitive, you know, that people can be fined up to $2,000 for handing out free food. Is that correct?
There are some panhandling ordinances there in Dallas. It's something I don't agree with. I've talked to the city council about that, and as a businessman myself, I appreciate the issue. We're trying to revive downtown Dallas. It's up and going. It's doing great. We want to attract businesses. We want to attract people. They don't want to be accosted. It's a natural thing. So I think the conflict is understandable. The question is, what's the best answer and what's the best solution to this? As I said, we have taken best practices around the country, and we're learning about this issue from cities like Denver and Baltimore that have approached this in a different fashion. Police don't like panhandling ordinances. It just creates a problem for them, and it really doesn't drive panhandling down. But I think the lawmakers in Dallas decided they were going to send a signal to say, well, we're doing a lot of great things for the homeless. We're going to ask they don't get in people's face asking for money.
In general, though, that does seem to be a sort of maybe perhaps a way when there's a knee-jerk response to the problem. If we get rid of the panhandlers, we've gotten rid of the problem.
I think so. And, you know, as you well know, a lot of panhandlers aren't homeless. You know, I think it's dealing with another issue, not really solving homeless problems. And that's why we as a city, and I think the business community has come around to this as well, is the best solution for this is to solve our chronic homeless problem. And I think it's important to say is what we're trying to do is not end homelessness per se by the year 2014, but to end chronic homelessness. And that's the hardcore folks that have been out there for over a year on the street. And
we're going to continue this discussion about the problem of homelessness and how cities can solve it. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 800-989-8255. Thank you for your break, and then come back. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Almost every big city faces the problem of homelessness and what to do about it. We've talked so far about Dallas's 10-year plan. Now, we want to know what's worked where you live. Give us a call. And if you've ever been homeless, do you think we can solve the problem of homelessness? 800-989-8255. You can reach us by email. The address is talk@npr.org. Our guest is Mike Rawlings. He chairs the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance, a position that earned him the nickname the Dallas Homeless Czar. That's quite a nickname, Mike.
stupid.
We're going to take a call now. We're going to go to Doug, and Doug is calling from Washington State. Hi, Doug.
Hi, I was homeless for about 5 years. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm here.
I was brought out of it by an old woman who had a large yard, and I mowed grass and take out the trash and some other chores like that. And I have a $60 a month pension for my first job.
And what brought you to homelessness in the first place, Doug?
I have a problem with depression. I tried to kill myself twice in 1989,
uh-huh.
And I spent 3 months in the state mental health hospital. But it can be mitigated, I believe. I think what needs to be done is to build a job around me rather than expecting me to fit into the existing system. Maybe shorter hours, I have a trouble with, I'm not emotionally resilient, depression.
Did you find that there were services where you lived that were helpful to you or not? You're saying that in the end it was one woman who seemed to have helped you. Were there government services that were available to you that did help or not?
I went to a homeless shelter a couple nights, but it's a disease-ridden place, crowded, full of people spitting and smoking and a lot of drug addicts and alcoholics, and I'm not one of those. So I prefer to sleep out in the forest.
In the forest?
The illegal camp.
I see. Mike Rollins, I wonder if you could respond to what that is.
Once again, you see the import of mental illness in this this situation, and I'm so happy to hear that you're back off out of the forest, if you will, and you're dealing with this. And I think it's so important. You mentioned the front of the show the importance of getting housing, and you said customized solutions, and that's what's called permanent supportive housing. And housing first is a model that's being used across the United States. You give a caller a key to an apartment and say, this is your apartment. We're going to build some services around you. We're going to build some jobs around you. And we're going to give you the mental health needs you want. And now you are independent. Yes, you've got a lot of support, but this is much cheaper for a city to do it that way and deal with an individual that's in the streets. The studies show that these individuals can cost us $100,000 a year with ambulance service, the police, the panhandling issues, the jails, all the services that are needed. $100,000 put against apartments, some job training, some job customized jobs, and the mental health needs can go a long, long way, and you suddenly start to end chronic homelessness, and that's the job we're trying to do.
Doug, before I let you go, does that sound right to you? Does that sound like?
Yeah, it sounds like a good attempt. I believe I can work, and the problem is that I have an empty application. People are very mistrustful of me when I'm looking for work.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and
one
did
of the
you
other
say you have a place. I'm sorry. Did you say you do have a place to live in?
I'm losing it now. Sorry. I think I'll be all right. I'm going to move in with my sister, I believe. Anyway, I've had a couple of job experiences, and they were just too tough.
Yeah.
You know, you'd ride your bike across town to get to this warehouse sort of situation. You're out in the cold, open air, sawing wood, for example, all day long. And mostly, or two-thirds of the workers are Mexican. And those are the sort of jobs I could get. And I have a degree in science. And it's just very, it's emotionally difficult for me. I'm not resilient emotionally, and I end up quitting these jobs. I had a job in a paint factory, also in your health hazard, and I was injured a couple of times.
Well, Doug, I thank you very much for calling and sharing this
with
me. Bye-bye. Mike Rollins, that sounds fairly difficult to you?
It does, and furthermore, he said a lot of people don't trust me enough to give me a job. So many, at least in Dallas, I think across the city, are ex-offenders as well. And people don't want to hire an ex-felon, somebody that has been in prison. And that's a stigma that we've got to get around as well. We've got to create a way that's easier for employees to deal with that issue, and we've got to do some training on both sides of that phenomenon as we start to bridge this gap between normality and this estrangement that your caller just was feeling.
I'd like to bring in our second guest now. Joining us from Byline Studios in San Francisco is Karen Gunaisen. She is managing attorney for Homebase, a nonprofit public policy law firm that works with communities to develop responses to homelessness. Karen, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Lynn.
Now, San Francisco...
I think this is probably a pretty good place to break on this one, but isn't that interesting? And certainly the challenge that people like Mike Rawlings had ahead of them to work with the homeless, and then
you throw in the matter of crime and narcotics addiction and drug use and a number of other things, sexual assaults, etc., and you see that it's a problem that everybody, in terms of social service agencies, just about have some part of the total responsibility to resolve this problem. But Dallas's approach to sort of customize their services around the particular homeless person and the figures that Mike Rawlings mentioned, that maybe perhaps one of these homeless persons could cost the city as much as $100,000 a year. I'd like to see the data on that, but I can imagine some of those costs. It's a sort of a novel way to go at this, build the services around the homeless person, and I think the guy that called in was a pretty good example of a number of a high percentage of the people that are in a homeless condition. They do not have the stamina to stay on the job and work. They're often depressed, along with some other problems. So a very interesting interesting area, and we hope to hear more about this certainly in the future. Well, Audrey, tonight I knew you had your blonde joke, and this is a tough role to turn. I mean, transition to go from you know, the state of affairs of people in homeless condition to your joke, but let's go ahead and do that. And we were going to talk a little bit tonight in the news about how executions had gone down to a 13-year low, and most of that is because of the de facto stay on executions while the Supreme Court decides the legality of lethal injections. The 42 executions recorded in 2007 are the fewest since 1994. Texas still led the nation with 26, and I assume Texas is done for the year, but I know in past years they've actually had some just several days before Christmas, but I don't know if that's true. But Audrey, let's go here and see what your good joke is tonight, because I'm told it has something to do with this execution story.
Professor Haley, the blonde joke tonight is a little morbid, and it relates to one of your news stories to tonight about capital punishment. Emily and Mike thought it was okay, so here it is. Three women are about to be executed for crimes. One's a brunette, one's a redhead, and one's a blonde. Two guards bring the brunette forward, and the executioner asks if she has any last requests. She says no, and the executioner shouts, "Ready, aim." Suddenly the brunette yells, "Earthquake!" Everyone is startled and looks around. She manages to escape. The angry guards then bring the redhead forward, and the executioner asks if she has any last requests. She says no, and the executioner shouts, "Ready, aim." The redhead then screams, "Tornado!" Yet again, everyone is startled and looks around. She too escapes execution. By this point, the blonde had figured out what the others did. The guards bring her forward, and the executioner asks if she has any last requests. She also says no, and the executioner shouts, "Ready, aim." The blonde shouts, "Fire."
Oh, no. Oh, well, that's an interesting one. A little morbid. I think that's the most morbid one you've had, Audrey, since we've started all this. I was wondering if, Emily, you said you brought along a little ditty tonight that you wanted to play, and where did you get this? You say you're not going to tell us? Something to put us in the holiday spirit, is that correct? Okay, you go ahead, throw the switch.
Hey.
Here come the elf and green.
I need a work break.
F-E-I-G.
The E-I-G.
Here come the Elfin Green.
Elfin Green.
Working in the toy shop.
Dig it, Elliot. The workforce
dress in green. We are a team. If you're at the North Pole, do ever take in the scene.
The toy's built by me, EIG.
Means what I make is what will be under your tree.
So don't diss us for our size. It's how working fools kill to meet the closet deadline. Pound the nails in. Gives me great joy just making a toy for all the good girls and boys.
Here's a long list, Santa Tart.
This girl was a kite.
This boy was a shiny bike.
A bingo look in his sack. He never quite knows what the EIG will pack.
Here come the elfin green, elfin green. Feel them in the toy shop. Oh, oh. Here come the elfin green, elfin green. They've been working nonstop.
Oh, oh, oh.
Although we dress in green, it's just a thing.
Some elves have done for years or so, it seems.
From the North Pole projected flight.
And when the Batman takes off, it's really quite a sight. He puts your toys right under the tree.
He comes sneaking around your house when he knows you're fast asleep.
So go on and take a chance. Go on ahead and leave the cookies on the nightstand.
Worth all the goodies he brings back is the pay we get for making all the stuff in his toy sack.
Work the bandsaw, use the glue gun.
If it weren't for us, would Christmas still be fun?
Hey, where's my power drill?
You guys see my hammer?
Here's another dollhouse order.
Let me see you just build with me, just build with me, just build with me. Come on, let me see you just work with me, just work with me, just work with me. Come on, let me see you just pack with me, just pack with me, just pack with me. Come on and take it outside to the sleigh.
It's freezing.
All right, definitely interesting. Save me a clip of that. I might use that some other place. Very interesting piece. Ladies and gentlemen, we're close to the end of the show tonight, but I wanted to talk about a dual act out of Maricopa County. I won't be able to go through both of the stories now, but Sheriff Joe Apaya now, he's taking drunk drivers and he's putting them in pink underwear and making them wear T-shirts that say they're Sheriff DUI chain gang. Then on the front of the shirt it says clean and sober, and he's making them perform burials of people who died as a result of alcohol abuse or through drunk driving. Now they don't attend the funeral, but what they do is actually dig the grave sites. Boy, that's something that ought to make you think about what you were doing. And then along with him, the county attorney, or their DA, so to speak, what he's doing, he's put billboards strategically throughout the city of Phoenix, and on the billboard are the pictures of people who have been convicted of felony DUIs in that city. Isn't that incredible? And you can actually go to a website also, and it's called the Hall of Shame, and you can actually see on the website the pictures of some of these same people and those the names of those people who have misdemeanor conviction. So here's another idea of trying to use shame in the rehabilitation and deterrence process, but kind of an interesting idea. I had another little, tonight we're going to feature another little rap song about driving and not drinking, but perhaps we'll save that for another time. So again, folks, I apologize for the problems we had coming on the show tonight. That's really the longest gap that we've ever had in the show. We used to, in the beginning, Blog Talk Radio was just getting started. We've had a couple of things happen now and then, but nothing like this. So they must have had server problems, and again, I apologize for that, and we hope the next week things will be going smoothly. Next week, we'll be working from the road. I'll have more to tell you about that, and be sure to check on the website and see what's going to go on for that week. So Audrey, she's giving us a signal now that it's time for the show to be over, so folks, we're going to go ahead and sign off, and you can be sure that we'll be meeting again.
Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.